serious and respected history podcast on the World Wide Web. Today, Angela Barnes, what are we doing?
Ah, John. Well, we had a little... We did an episode, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago about the Battle of Hastings.
Yes.
And during
and what
that
was our
episode,
main takeout?
Our main take about it was be a good, wine bad, essentially.
Was that the bloody Normans imposed snobby wine on the English. And we still go to a bloody posh party and they go red or white. And John's there going, how would Jackie feel after I went and got some cans of lager from the off licence? Would she think it was acceptable? The answer was no, by the way.
Well, the answer is yes, if you'd ask me, because I do this. We're both beer drinkers more than wine drinkers. We love a beer. And so we thought, well, why not do an episode about the history of beer, particularly the history of beer in Britain, because it's so entwined in our history.
I think the research needed for this. I have researched this like no other, Angela.
The minor error we have made, John, is recording this episode at 11 o'clock in the morning.
You speak for yourself. The book I read on this was A History of English Ale and Beer by H.A. Monckton. This was published in 1966. And it said, average prices today are 1 and 6 pence for a pint of draft beer in a pub.
You can't say that we are history. Don't bring things bang up to date, John O'Farrell.
It's great, this book. It's going, who knows whether the current spending on by the big brewers of advertising to promote lager will see it adopted by the English. Only time will tell.
And indeed, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
The book I've read, slightly more contemporary, is Man Walks Into a Pub by Pete Brown. Pete Brown is a great writer on beer. He also wrote a brilliant book called Hops and Glory about the history of pale ale.
Yeah.
India Pale Ale, IPA. Yeah. So we'll touch on that. But if you want, I mean, that's the book to read. You could do a whole episode on that. And there's going to be lots of things I say during this where I go, you could do a whole episode on that.
What's wrong with H.A. Monckton in 1966?
God love you, John. Were you what year were you born, John?
1962. Born under Harold Macmillan. I remember 1966 World Cup.
Do you?
Yeah.
Of course, it was 10 years before I was born, John.
I know. This is the difference between our historical takes. For me, it's all current affairs. Can I say, listeners, that doing beer was Angela's suggestion. So any suggestion that I'm some old soak, I refuse. My lawyers will be on to you.
Well, I want to shout out to my friend Emma Inch, who is currently, I believe, although it might have, the new winner might have been announced, but she certainly last year was the... British Beer Writer of the Year.
Wow.
And it's a, you know, there's not a lot of women in that industry.
No.
So, Emma, this one's for you. And all women who like drinking beer, because we do exist, John, and we do like it out of pint glasses, no matter what Al Murray will tell you.
Oh, how disappointing. I'd like a little snowball for the lady, little sherry. I've got this thing that beer names in pubs, their titles are a bit Brexity. You get Spitfire Ale and sort of Crusader Bitter. And
so true. Bombardier.
Bombardier. You know, they never go Monetary Union Lager, do you? Or...
They're either Brexity or they're a bit, you know, Country Pursuits.
Right, yeah, Shooters.
Which in itself is a little bit Brexity, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the old Stoat or...
That's my two cents. Let's have more Remainer bitter names, please. That's John's...
I'm calling this Beer a British Social History. We're not condoning alcoholism in this. You know, obviously some people have issues with, you know, and we're not glamorising beer, although it is bloody brilliant.
It's a great
thing. But the fact is that humans... pretty much forever have been trying to get off their tits one way or another.
Indeed.
The upper Paleolithic tribes of hunter-gatherers, go back to our Origin of Homo Sapiens podcast if you want to. But, you know, 38 to 45,000 years ago, they were, you know, finding substances. And every society in history has used intoxicating substances, either sparingly or liberally. Sometimes
magic mushrooms, tobacco.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be under the guise of religion, and sometimes it was just for shits and giggles.
What's interesting about some of these addictive substances like tobacco or alcohol is that I think there's some sort of scientific basis for the fact that our DNA sort of gets used to it. So Europeans generally can cope with alcohol. But when we took alcohol to the New World or to Australia, the people there became much more addicted to alcohol much more quickly because they hadn't had 1,000 generations of it. Whereas tobacco, which was brought from the New World to Europe, you know, the Native Americans were able to smoke tobacco without having 40 packs of Marlboro Lights a week.
Yeah.
Whereas we have had our, you know, many lives ruined and destroyed by tobacco in a different way. So the addictive substances of different continents have had different effect on the people.
No, in sort of South Asia, I think in Japan particularly, I think tolerance for alcohol is really low, isn't it? It's, you get drunk much more quickly.
When I was in Australia, you know, the problem for Aboriginals, for first Australians, as they're called, terrible problem with alcohol. But it's just not something that's in their culture or has been in their sort of their experience for thousands of years, like it has for us.
Yeah.
And
that
think
might explain why Australian lager's so piss weak.
Well, I think I said this in the Ballot Hastings one, but I think I have a genetic predisposition to tolerate beer, but not wine.
Yeah,
wine makes me feel terrible, and I don't like the way it makes me drunk. It makes me a bit cross. Whereas beer makes me all
Anglo-Saxon, John.
Meh, a bit of Celt, you know. But beer makes me all jovial and jokey and relaxed, you know. And it's just, I think, and I feel fine.
Gin makes me cry. the Egyptians were drinking beer. The Babylonians, the Mesopotamians, they were all drinking beer. There was much more rain back then in the Middle East than there is now.
Right.
So it's believed that it was there that cereals were first cultivated for food from around 6000 BC. It's not clear when people started deliberately fermenting cereals into beer, but they were certainly writing about it as far back as 3000 BC.
Okay.
Ancient Egyptians loved it.
And when we say beer, Angela, we're not talking about the beer that we have now, are we? It would look very different. No, hops in it would have been fermented malt or whatever.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, in the Egyptians, the beer, in inverted commas, that they had, the Egyptians, like 40% of all the grain they harvested went into making beer. They were proper lagerlouts, the Egyptians, well, not lager, but their beer was...
That explains
like
the pyramids, Angela. It's like, that's one of those things you go, I'll tell you what we should do. Let's build a massive pointy tower. And it's like, no one next morning went, is this really such a good idea for
our energy? Did we build something last night? but their beer was like a thick porridge-like substance that had to be drunk through a straw. And I don't know about you, John, but when I sup an ale, there's the one thing I think is, do you know what's missing from this? Lumps.
you never tasted my homebrew, Angela.
Oh, no.
When I was a student, I was a mad homebrewer because you're a student, high alcohol consumption, low income. I solved that impossible equation with mad for homebrewing. I'd have 4 40 pint barrels in our student kitchen. I mashed my own malt, which is to say I took the grain, I heated it to the correct temperature to convert the malt to maltose. I fermented it for a week. I added the hops. I chose the Fuggles or the Golden Hops. And my house was like a pub. Everyone would come round and my brother would go.
I bet you had so many friends at university.
My brother would go, none of them like you, John. I only come around for the free beer.
I had a similar thing at university, except it's because my dad ran a sex shop. And the internet wasn't a thing then. I had lots of friends because they got free porn.
Oh, my God. What classy background we both have. My brother confessed to me recently. He said, I used to come down to your place in Exeter and you'd say, oh, I've got a really good one here, Pat. Just look at this. And I'd pour it carefully from the barrel. It was all clear and a little bit of sparkle and a little bit of head. I'd say, taste that. And he'd sip it and go, that's a good one, John. And he said every time it was disgusting. For years and years, he'd come down and go, oh, no, it's interesting. And he's going,
did you name your brews?
I did. They'd be like, when the Falklands was invaded, it was like Task Force Tipple or Malvinas Mild. As 1983 election was announced, I brewed a Labour landslide bitter. And it was completely undrinkable, which was a sign.
You jinxed that.
Yeah,
what happened there. Was it strong, the stuff?
It was all. I made it all sort of varying strengths. I made stout, I made mild, I made bitter. I've made one, which I've read in a book, is if you put the carcass of a chicken into the brew, that ferments as well. So I tried that once. It's called cock ale. I tell you what it tasted like. It tasted cock. Like I put the carcass of a chicken in the beer.
Oh, my God. That's disgusting.
I do remember having the...
Again, I've never drunk a beer and thought, do you know what this needs? Dead flesh.
Well, at one time we had the Liverpool poets. We invited them down to Exeter. We had Roger McGough and Adrian Patton and all them. And they came back to my house afterwards because the Literary Society had organised it. And they got pissed on my homebrew. And I remember Roger McGough laughing at Very Macho Bitter. It was just called Very Macho Bitter. And I was so chuffed that Roger McGough had liked my joke.
Roger McGough in Scaffold?
Yes, right, yeah.
So Lily the Pink could have been based on your beer.
No, it's not. Lily the Pink was like when I was 5 years old.
I'm sorry, anyway, John. It's just all the olden days to me.
I know. But anyway, I was a mad brewer and I know the whole business. So what we're talking about is beer is made from malt, which is the germinated barley. So it's not. There's no alcohol content in hops. It all comes from the sugar in malt in barley.
Well, yeah. So we're back in the sort of ancient world. So we've got the
John's student days. Yeah.
John's student days. So there were lots of myths and stories surrounding beer in Mesopotamia. There was the Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Is that how you pronounce it?
I've no idea. Ancient Mesopotamian's a bit rusty.
It's the oldest known narrative poem in the world, in which this wild man, Enkidu, I'm not sure how you say it, he's given beer to drink. And he ate until he was full, drank 7 pitchers of beer, and his heart grew light, his face glowed, and he sang out with joy. That's the first record we have.
Oh,
it's about human mortality. And the idea is that apparently the story was saying, look, we're all going to die, so you might as well get pissed, essentially.
Good.
Which I think is a good
life is short, have fun. Get pissed.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There were similar myths all over the world. In Africa, there was a myth which was similar to that of Pandora's box. But at the bottom of the box, instead of hope, like there was in Pandora's box, they had a gourd full of beer.
Yeah,
which I think is a better story.
That's
personally
a better story, yeah.
Fairly recently, last year, archaeologists found evidence of the first Iron Age beer in England. Was dated back over 2,000 years. They found that during some roadworks in Cambridgeshire. So that's quite exciting. So what we should probably... What is beer, John? You've given us a... It's basically, from what I can make out... And I'm not a scientist, John, and this is not a science podcast. And it all gets very involved and people get very wanky about beer. So we're going to try and steer away from that. But it's essentially, you've got these microscopic single-celled fungi, these yeasts, and they float about looking for warm, damp places that have got sugar in them, and they eat the sugar, and what comes out the other end is CO2 and alcohol.
Yeah, so basically you've got, so when I wasn't making loads of beer, I was also making wine. I had these demijohns, a dozen gallon things, and so they'd all be bubbling with that little U-bend seal at the top. So you put your fruit in there, the sugar turns to alcohol, the yeast lives on the sugar, it sort of pisses out alcohol, basically, this thing. And it eventually it's poisoned, the yeast is poisoned by the alcohol in which it is living, and that's when it's finished fermenting. And I saw this and I thought, what a allegory for the planet that is, that they're sitting there getting pissed, these yeast are getting, they're all getting pissed until they poison themselves with what they've produced. And I wrote this little short story about it when I was like 20. And then I gave my girlfriend at the time this Kurt Vonnegut novel I'd been reading and said, I'll read this, it's really good. And she just read out this sentence from the novel, which is basically the short story I'd just spent about a week writing. You just nicked it from Kurt Vonnegut. And I went, oh, God.
Oh,
shit. I thought it was a really clever story.
You plagiarised. Oh.
Yeah, so I must have at some level sort of had this idea go in. But yeah, that's an allegory for what we're doing to the planet is
what
just
I
getting pissed
about,
and poisoning ourselves.
What I love about beer is an alcohol production in general is that it's only like 140 odd years ago that they really understood what was happening. Up until that point, it was this magical thing happened when you put these things, yeast and sugars together. And in the Middle Ages, they thought it was magic, you know, and they thought it was something in the air, and they called the thing that was in the air that they thought caused fermentation, they called it God is good.
God is good, because he gives us this.
God is good.
God is good.
Isn't that
keeps
great?
Cropping up in this book. God is good. And it's like in the official documents, you know, God
brilliant.
Is good.
It's brilliant.
I mean, it does happen in the wild. I mean, you have the sort of bloom. If you see a prune or a plum and you see that sort of misty sheen on the outside, that's like a what's called a bloom. And that is a yeast. And so if you mash that up and leave it on the ground, it'll ferment, and you see cows all asleep in fields.
I was going to say, every now and then you hear these stories, don't they, about a herd of elephants come across a rotting fruit and all get pissed. And that's why wine, or a forerunner of wine, is the first way that people got pissed, because fermentation happens quite easily in fruit.
Yes.
Doesn't it? And yes. It can happen quite accidentally and easily. Yeah. But grain, of course, of which beer is made, barley, whatever,
yeah.
It's got a tougher outer layer than fruit. So it's harder for fermentation to occur, harder for the yeast to get in. So while we were hunter-gatherers roaming the savannah, you'd pick what you needed as you went. As we began to settle and store grain, agriculture began.
You would
harvest grain, store it in pots, and it's the grain that was stored in pots would then get damp and eventually would ferment. And that's where we went, hang on a minute, that thing that happens with the fruit is happening over here as well.
I'll have one of those, please.
Beer.
And a snowball for the lady.
And a snowball for the lady. Do you know what? I love snowballs, though. I do. Early beers had herbs added to them. So you'd have like rosemary or thyme or they'd add grapes because that would speed up the fermentation.
Okay.
Honey.
Every now and then at Christmas, people go, what can I get John for Christmas? Oh, he loves his beer. And I'll get a bottle of fancy farted around with beer. So this is German beer, which has black currants added. And then there's this other one that's got cherries. And this one's got loads of different herbs. It's like, it's disgusting. I just don't give it. I don't want it.
I don't like fruit beers. Apart from the good old Belgian Kriek. I don't mind that. The like original sort of Belgian cherry beer. But I can only drink one of them.
They're stop mucking around with what's perfect.
I agree. I'm allergic to grapefruit.
Are you?
I really can't have grapefruit.
Oh, that's
and a lot of these sort of new craft beers, which we'll come on to later.
Yeah.
Put grapefruit in. Really check. And I've had to even like tweet the brewers to go, is there grapefruit in this? Because a lot of hops taste quite grapefruity.
I see. That's weird.
Sometimes I'll drink it and go, oh, shit, is that grapefruit? Anyway, lots of archaeologists believe that brewing was one of the reasons we settled in these communities, because you had to be in one place.
Yeah, can't get the beer all shaken up. Yeah.
You know, exactly. So Pete Brown, in his book that I read, he says that beer is the root cause of civilization, and I, for one, will drink to that.
I'll drink to that too, Angela. Let's say it's nothing to do with agriculture or, you know.
No.
We've got a pub here, let's stay, is what they're saying.
Exactly. Let's do that. Why would you go anywhere else? So beer is really rooted in Northern Europe.
Right. Yes.
Northern Europe mythology, full of ale drinking. They love it. And when the Romans came here with their wine.
Yeah, fancy Romans.
They found that beer had beaten them.
Yeah.
We already had beer. In fact, the Vikings, they loved it. There's a hall in Valhalla, according to Viking Norse mythology, where you basically spend an eternity getting pissed with Odin. And the beer comes from a goat tethered to a tree who, when you milk it, produced the finest beer. There you go.
That's a hard religion to sort of believe in, but I think it, you know, I'll go with that one.
If I had to choose,
I'll go with over Mormonism.
Emperor Julian, he thought that this wine made from barley was an insult to the god of wine, Bacchus, himself. And he said, who made you and from what? By the true Bacchus, I know you not. He smells of nectar, but you smell of goat.
Because he's emperor. Everyone has to go, oh, it's very witty. Great speech, sir. Great.
So in Britain, the Romans get here and we're already brewing, but we're brewing mead and cider rather than beer. And because Britain's heavily forested, right? So there's no point in clearing space for grain when you can get wasted on what you've already got, which is basically anything with naturally occurring sugars. And then the Angles and Saxons came in 5th century AD.
Yes.
And they'd already been drinking, like we said, in Northern Europe, they'd already been drinking what they called ol or ilu, which became ale. So they eventually see off the Romans, because we all know that beer drinkers are better fighters than wine
That's
drinkers.
Like, right, in the car park now. Julian.
Yeah, exactly. Julian, is that your name?
I've got a quote here from St. Cuthbert, who said, this is in the 600s actually, but he says that it is reported that in your diocese, the vice of drunkenness is too frequent. This is an evil peculiar to our race, meaning the English. Yeah. Neither the Franks, nor the Gauls, nor the Lombards, nor the Romans, nor the Greeks commit it. So
bullshit.
Basically, we are the drinkers of Europe by the 6th century.
See, all this did was prove what everyone in a city centre on a Friday night knows, is that you fight better on beer, right? There's never been a Sun headline that says, leave for milk louts, right? And the Anglo-Saxon, the word beer, it's from the Latin word bibere, which the Anglo-Saxons started using, which means to drink.
Right.
So that's how fundamental beer is. It's a name that's synonymous with just drink.
So who was brewing this then?
Well, this is what I love, John. I spoke earlier at the top of the show about my friend Emma, who's a beer writer.
Yes.
And of course, like with so many things throughout history, John, what happens is women quietly go along. No, yes, you can. You can shush and listen now. Women quietly get along doing a job really well, and then men come along and go, we'll take it from here, and we want loads of praise for it. Right, so basically, in the Middle Ages, brewing was the job of the woman of the house. It was an everyday activity like baking or all the other things that they did to keep a household going. Right. The women that brewed were known as alewives. I really fancy being an alewife.
Alewife.
And in almost all these ancient mythologies that mention beer, beer was a gift to the women, and it was always passed on by feminine deities, which I think is quite interesting. And in Western cultures, alewife was the key figure until the 16th century. And that's because, obviously, we had this church-driven patriarchy, which really blew up in the 1500s and decided that anything impressive had to be the domain of the man, be it art, be it, you know, anything. And it happens with everything throughout history. Yes, you're doing a great job, dear, but we'll take it from here. Turns out all this thing you've been doing without a fuss is quite skilled. So now we want some praise for it, please. Now it's an art. Now it's a profession, right? Chefs are the same as this.
Right, of course.
You know, women have cooked forever, prepared food for their... Suddenly men do it and it becomes fucking MasterChef, you know? But anyway,
I hear you. But, I mean, apart from anything else, it was safer than water, wasn't it? Drinking beer was something that the whole family did because in the process of making beer, the water was heated and germs were killed. And so whilst your local well was full of all the germs that came from the open sewers, beer was your main source of liquid. You got drinking beer, the children drank beer, everyone drank pints and pints of beer every day as the safest thing to drink.
What an alewife would do, they'd make their initial brew, which was a strong brew, and then they'd recycle the same grain, mash it again, and make a weaker brew out of it, which they would call table beer.
Okay.
And this table beer would be drunk by the women and the children, and it'd be served with every meal, including breakfast. So, John, we could have had a beer at 11 o'clock in the morning.
A pint of table beer.
A breakfast beer. That's what I like to call it. So throughout the Middle Ages, throughout the Anglo-Saxon period, we're drinking beer and getting royally pissed. And then, like you said in our Battle of Hastings episode, the Normans come and they bring wine. Some historians have suggested that the reason Harold's armies made so many mistakes is that they were still pissed from celebrating the Stamford Bridge.
Victory.
I was going to say the Stamford Bridge result. That makes it sound like a Chelsea game. From the Stamford Bridge battle that they won.
Having soldiers off their heads is a historical sort of thing that goes right back. In Vietnam War, they're worried that all the soldiers were stoned. They're all smoking a lot of grass. It's just, having drunkenness in the armies is no new thing.
I mean, if you're, you know, basically cannon fodder, I'd want to be pissed as well.
Yeah, quite often they needed them to be a little bit pissed to be up for it.
So binge Britain is not a new thing. You know, this is... We've always been piss heads, let's be honest.
I'm not quite sure if it's ever been as bad as Clapham High Street on a Saturday night,
well,
I will tell you. If you go down there, I took my daughter down there. We were driving back from somewhere once at midnight and she was little. And I said, people were shouting at each other, there's a glass smashed and somebody's shouting and screaming. And I said, wow, Lily, have you ever seen anything like that before? She went, only on EastEnders.
I'll tell you something, John. I live in Brighton, and if you live in a stag do town, I bet Clapham High Street's got nothing on that. One of the reasons it said that people, I love this excuse for people in the Middle Ages drinking so much, is because of the vessels they drank out of.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't have flat bottoms. They drank out of horns and bowls.
They couldn't put them down. And they had little pegs in them, didn't they, to mark?
That's right.
They had little pegs, and so taking someone down a peg or two, was that related to
that came from
moving
that,
the
Edgar,
peg?
One of the Saxon kings decreed that you should only drink so much, and so you had a little peg attached to your butt. Yeah, so to bring someone down a peg or two was to beat them in a drinking competition, essentially.
I see. Okay, that's impressive.
And of course, they had no way of knowing how strong the beer they were brewing was.
No.
And it's thought that it was much stronger than the beer that we have today.
There's a great bit I read in one of the books, and you might have done this research as well, but later on in the sort of Middle Ages, the way that a beer tester would test whether beer was ready or not was he would pour it on a flat wooden surface, sit in it for half an hour, and then when he stood up, if it was sticky, it wasn't brewed enough. It was too sugary. So, but if he got up and it was just a bit wet, then that was fine. And that was his. That's I've done my job. My work is done. I'm the technician around here.
John, you know, You know how those of us who work in the arts are supposed to retrain?
That's what we could do.
I think I've found my vocation.
Sit in puddles of beer.
Yes, to see if it sticks.
In Magna Carta, which I think you're just coming up to, one of the stipulations was that there should be one measure for ale. Because there were concerns about, the barons were concerned about all these different measures for ale. I think that what they were basically saying was, yeah, fill that up a bit, would you? Because it's a bit short, that is, if you don't mind.
So that was the first time, wasn't it, the Magna Carta
in
the 13th century? First time there was sort of standard measures.
I was in a pub in the centre of London and asked for a pint. And this very smiley sort of woman behind the bar went, sure. And she poured me this glass of beer, and I'm not joking, it was half full. I just handed it over and I went, is it your first day? She went, she's Australian. She went, how did you know? I went, yeah, I wouldn't do that to anyone else. You really, it's quite important to fill it up to the very top. Oh, really? I just thought you wanted a glass of beer. And no, that's sacrilege. You can't just put a bit of beer in a glass and just think we'll be happy with that. So that's what the Magna Carta was complaining about. I think they had some Australian barmaid going, oh, I thought you just wanted a bit of beer in a glass. Sorry, do continue, Angela.
No, beer was an important part of celebration in the Middle Ages. And I love some of these. So you'd have ales for all occasions. Yeah. So you had church ales, midsummer ales. Ales was the name of the celebration as well. So was the party. She had these church ales, midsummer ales, and they were really debauched affairs. But this is my favourite one, and I am going to reinstate this for my upcoming wedding, is the bride ales, which is where the word bridal comes from.
Oh, so
because the word bride, John, actually has the same root as the word brew.
Okay.
And the bride ale is where the bride's mother would brew a batch of ale for the wedding.
Right.
And they'd hold the reception on the village green.
Yeah.
And they would sell the ale that the bride's mother brewed. And passers-by would buy it at the standard rate. But all the wedding guests, they would pay loads more for it because that would be the way to provide the bride's family with a dowry.
Fantastic. Bride
ale. So they'd flog a bit of...
You learn something every day.
Yeah, there you go. So I like that. But my favourite ale, John, is groaning ale.
Groaning ale, that's, I've had some of those.
Groaning ale is when a woman was pregnant, a local alewife, she'd brew a batch of particularly strong ale for the woman, right? And it was timed to mature when she was due to give birth.
Right.
And then when the labour began, both the birthing mother and the midwife would crack it open and drink it just to make the whole ordeal more bearable.
This is like my labour landslide bitter.
Yeah. And then they'd get the newborn baby and they would wash the baby in beer.
Oh, this explains a lot. This is I think this is what happened with me.
It's so rooted in our history, beer. I love it. They weren't washing them in wine, John. They were washing them in beer.
In beer. Yeah, definitely on their head.
Now, after the decline of the Roman Empire, Catholic Church becomes the dominant force in Europe. And like they do, they took over most aspects of life, including brewing.
Okay. The monks with their brewing.
Alcohol and the church have always been sort of intertwined. You know, you've got obviously the blood of Christ in the wine and things like that. And it's
I just want to pick you up there. And see, that wouldn't have been my translation to the Christ's blood turn into wine. I would have had to turn to Breakspear's bitter, I think.
Yeah,
a pint of landlord.
But it's interesting because other drugs existed apart from alcohol, you know, other hallucinogenic drugs and things. And it's interesting that the church only really condoned the use of alcohol. And it's thought to be because what alcohol does while it gets you pissed, it never sort of connects you. It doesn't give you a gateway to a new world like other drugs might do.
Right.
And that might affect your relationship with, inverted commas, God.
Okay, that's quite interesting. So
it's
things
quite
like...
interesting that's how in the Western world particularly we end up with alcohol being perfectly legal and magic mushrooms not being.
Yes, or Fly Garrett. Scandinavians, meanwhile, were really into their hallucinogenic mushrooms. The whole thing of flying reindeers comes from, you know, drinking the urine of reindeers that had eaten the red spotty mushrooms. And any place where you see flying in sort of mythology, like witches on broomsticks, women were imagined to have ingested hallucinogenic drugs by masturbating on the handles of broomsticks. And that's why the image of them flying on broomsticks is because that's why they got their trips by rubbing their naughty bits smeared with magic mushrooms or fly agaric. Yes, this is all, I don't know, I've tried it.
Well, let's get through this. I've got an experiment to do.
So you can see why the church were going, yeah, I'm not sure we're going to put this one in the, yeah, in the sermon for Sunday.
Yeah, let's stick with the one that just gives them a headache in the morning. Yeah. Let's do it with that one. So the monasteries then felt that they should control brewing. And of course, you had the whole Benedictine thing was going on, who pioneered self-sufficiency of monasteries. So they were growing their own food, and they were, and during Lent, lots of monks survived on just beer. And there's some records from the year 1004 from Burton Abbey, and they show that the daily allowance for its monks consisted of 1 gallon of strong ale and 1 gallon of weak ale. That was a daily allowance, John, was 16 pints of ale.
God, that's insane.
Three pints and I'm on the floor.
Do you remember that story about William Hague drinking 10 pints when he was a student for this job he had?
Oh, yes.
And everyone went, that's ridiculous. That's so clearly not true. I was the only person in the country to go, oh, no, I know that's true because I did that same job. So when I left university, I was the drayman's assistant, and we would go from pub to pub unloading all the beer. And this would be at 7 a.m, you'd go to your first beer, you'd put all the barrels in the cellar, and then you'd go up and chat with the publican and he'd pour you a pint. And this was at 7 a.m. And then you do your next pub at 7:30 a.m.
You'd get another pint.
The guy next to me was driving. He was having halves after about the first 3 pints.
Oh, that's all right then. He was having 7 halves.
Exactly. And so I had 10 pints, and I was 21, you know, and I had to negotiate these stacked up crates of empty mixer bottles on a trolley. And I remember I never tipped the whole load over. My last day, I came into Torquay on this hill, and the whole fucking lot went over on its side.
Oh my God.
These little Brit Vic and Schweppes bottles were rolling down the street. All these cars were crushing these glass bottles. And I was going, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I just saw that. And that was my job.
Wow. In Belgium, it's the Trappist monks, isn't it, that still make... It's the only monk tradition, really, that survives with beer. But I've got... I did a gig in Brussels about five years ago. And it was in this bar in Brussels. And I went in and they were really friendly and lovely. And they said, would you like a drink? And I said, oh, yeah, I'd love a beer. And they said, what would you like? And I said, surprise me. Right? And they gave me this pint of ale. And I'd sort of forgotten about Trappist beers being a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had this pint of ale and it was delicious. Right. It was really lovely. And I don't usually drink before I go on. But I was, you know, I was in another country. I thought,
oh, yeah.
And it's sort of gone down quite nicely, this beer. So they said, do you want another one? I was like, oh, sod it. Yeah, why not? What's the worst that can happen? What I hadn't realised, John, is before I went on stage, I drank 2 pints of beer that was 10%.
Oh, my God, it's like wine or something.
It was like wine.
2 pints of
wine. And I drank 2 pints of it and went on stage. And the beer they'd given me, they were laughing because they knew what they'd done to me.
Oh, no, that's not good.
It was a beer called Pays de Dieu, I think it was called. Okay. And it's a beer that is brewed by monks, but only on a full moon, apparently. Okay. And it's got this sort of reputation for being this mad beer. And yeah, I got on stage and I had to say to the audience, I'm sorry.
Oh, God,
He's given me 2 pints of your most lethal beer.
God, I did that for a Radio 4 recording once. I was like at the Edinburgh Festival and it was like... recording this story I'd written for Radio 4, and there's me and Romesh and Granny McGuire, and my wife and I went to this lovely riverside pub in Leith, and I said, I'm just going to have 1 pint before I do this. And Jack's going, well, one's okay, actually, but it was so delicious and the sun was shining. I said, I'm just going to have another one. I get on the microphone in front of this audience in Edinburgh Festival, and I'm going, so this is my story I've written. And it's like, I kept doing retakes, and they're going, what's wrong with this bloke? It's like, it's a big mistake.
Well, and the thing is well, adrenaline and beer don't mix, I think, as well. So if you've got a bit of performance adrenaline plus 2 pints, that probably doubles the effect of that alcohol.
Right.
We come on to now the hops, right? Hops are important. Because up to this point, we're not using hops.
Yes, so this is like the 1400s. The word beer had dropped out a bit, I think, from Saxon times. And it was referred to as ale. So what we know as ale is all the beer brewed from malted barley without the hop flavouring in it.
That's
Is that right?
That's right. So in the 8th and 9th centuries, Bavarian monks had discovered these hardy perennial hops. They're from the same family as cannabis and nettles.
Fantastic.
And the good thing about hops is their oils and resins were not only good for preserving the ale, they were good for it lasting longer, but also flavouring it.
Yes.
Ancient Egyptians used hops for flavouring, but then the art had been lost until these monks rediscovered it. And particularly in the warmer places in Europe, they started using hops in beer because it preserved the beer through the summer months where it had been impossible in the past.
But of course, in Britain, it was like, oh, what is this? What have you put in my ale? Yeah, exactly. You've ruined it. It took 100 years, apparently, for the British to get used to it.
Yeah, it was.
To go, actually, all right, I quite like it with the hops in.
Yeah. Well, it was these Flemish traders who brought it hops to Britain, and they landed in Kent and Sussex. And of course, Kent, the taste of it only really spread when the British went, oh, it makes my beer last longer. Oh, yeah, go on then.
Right.
If it means I can have more beer, yeah, definitely. So it took until the 1520s before hops were grown in Kent. And they had been, I grew up in Kent. But also my family who grew up in South London, so my grandmother's family from South London, from Deptford, but they would come down to Kent hop picking in the summer, in September every year. And I've got a lovely photograph of my grandmother as a baby with her mother and her grandmother hop picking in Paddock Wood in Kent. And
can I read out an account from this book about hop pickers in Kent,
Angela? Go on.
As a rule, they are uncleanly, their habits coarse, their language foul, and their morality doubtful.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Many persons in Kent prefer to lose several pounds rather than let their children go into the fields and associate with a mixed company from the East End. This is your lot we're talking about, Angela.
Yep. And then they settled there. They loved Kent so much that they went, we'll go and live there then. So everywhere in Kent, I grew up surrounded by oast houses, which were the sort of pointy roofed houses that were kilns to dry the oat.
They're distinctive, aren't they? You know you're in Kent when you see those.
Yeah, there's very few places. But it's funny because nowadays people build fake oasts all the time. I don't know if you've heard the latest audiobook by Alan Partridge, which is called From the Oast House.
Oh, that's right.
He's built his fake oast house to live in. And in fact, the estate I grew up on, our local pub, was called the Early Bird in Grove Green. And that was a fake oast, that pub. So the hops became popular. And as the debate went away about whether hops were right, so did the distinction between the two words ale and beer.
Yes.
So there was this short period of time where ale meant non-hops, beer meant hops.
Hops, but then absolutely. Now they're just interchangeable.
Then they became interchangeable again.
Except now it would sort of mean a more traditional beer, wouldn't it? You'd never call a lager an ale.
No. In the second half, we'll talk a bit more about different types of beer and what the differences are. Henry VIII, he instructed his brewer to never use hops, mostly because he hated monasteries rather than he didn't like the taste.
Right.
Some towns banned the use of hops. Norwich and Shrewsbury banned them. Monasteries, of course, had vineyards and made wine as well. So actually, by the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry, actually cemented Britain as a beer-drinking nation. Because once again...
It sort of finished off the wine.
The winemakers, off they go again. So, you know, the Romans came with wine. We saw them off. The Normans came with wine. We went, if you're posh.
The monks tried it.
And then the monks tried it and Henry VIII went, no. So we're really holding on to our beer.
I mean, it's a lot to do with our weather as well, of course, that we're, you know, grapes don't grow so well in the south of England as barley does.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is why distilling is better in Scotland and Ireland because, you know, they struggle to produce beer up there.
Absolutely. Let's take a little break.
Get a little glass of something.
John, you're going to follow the bear. I might chase the dragon just to get a bit better hit.
Oh, God, that's a different podcast altogether.
We'll see you in a bit.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, the dog's barking because we're just getting a delivery. Do you know what we're getting a delivery of?
Beer!
Beer!
Hey.
It's a delivery from Shepherd Neame coming in now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, Whitstable Bay, my current favourite ale.
My Christmas present from my kids last year was a pub crawl, because they said, what does John like? He likes having a drink with us, he likes a beer, and he likes history. So they took me on a historical pub crawl around central London. And so we went to the French House and they gave each of them had to read out some facts about it whilst we had the pint.
Brilliant.
And then we walked to the next pub and they told me about, it was a sort of literary history tour. It was fucking brilliant. And it was like the best present I've ever had. We just got pissed all afternoon going to all these different pubs.
Shep and Nemi, for listening, Whitstable Bay is my favourite beer. I particularly like their Ruby Ale. Thank you.
Oh God, this is shameful.
Hey, I've got no shame. Mate, people want to send me beer. That is entirely up to them.
Where did we get up to in the history of beer, Angela? Because you're getting a bit slow.
I am getting out of the yourself. So we talked about ale and beer being, synonymous and then not synonymous and then synonymous again. Yeah. So maybe we should look a little bit at different types of beer that there are and the history of those. So in this country, more recently, lager has been the popular go-to for the youth. Of today, your pale lagers, your pilsners and everything. And basically, I'm not going to go into the science of brewing because it's really dull.
No,
who cares?
It's a
whole other podcast. But ales are made with top fermenting yeast that work at warm temperatures. Lagers are made with bottom fermenting yeasts, which sounds rude.
The yeast they use is called Carlsbergus.
There you go.
Yeah, it is.
And the liquid needs to be cold for lagers. So there you go. So cold storage of beer, lagering, was done in caves and things before modern refrigeration. Yeah. And particularly in Germany is very famous for its production of lager, still is. They took the production of lager very seriously to the point where they enshrined it in law in the 16th century. 1516, they came up with their Reinheitsgebot, which is the purity law. And the purity law in German lager says that the only ingredients of lager should be water, hops and barley. Yes. Obviously, you need yeast for it, but they didn't include that in that because that's part of the brewing process, not an ingredient as such. Bavaria insisted on applying that throughout Germany. And it was a precondition of German unification in 1871 that all the states agreed to this lager production law. And it was only in 1987 that the law was seen as being protectionist because lots of imported beers didn't follow that.
Wow.
So it's been adapted since that it now only applies to German produced beers. So German produced beers are all just those ingredients.
The problem with just having those ingredients is that beer was often very cloudy and it wouldn't. And when glass came in, as opposed to wooden, horns or wooden bowls or tankards, you could see how cloudy it was. And some of it settled and some of it didn't. So they all sat around and said, I'll tell you what we haven't tried. We haven't tried dried sturgeon's bladder.
Yes. first thought, is it, I need about to you. Filter something.
What's the first thing you're going to try? Actually, originally they did it, they strained it through flannels, but then they said, I'll tell you what, it seems obvious now. As soon as you say it, it's obvious. But dried sturgeon's bladder, we sprinkle that, and then it will fall, icing glass finings will fall through the beer and take out all the cloudy yeast. And I used to add that to my homebrew, this little white powder, and take out the cloudiness. So vegetarians, strictly, can't have beer because it's got sturgeon's bladder in it.
Lots of beer now, particularly the young modern craft beers, lots of them are vegan now, aren't they? And they've sort
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. But sturgeons were like, this is a bit of bad luck.
Yeah. Different types of beer. We won't go through all of them because we haven't got forever. But I think it's quite a porter, I always find. Porter and stout is quite... Do you know why porter's called porter?
Was it named after Natalie Porter?
Yes, it was. Moving on. so in the early 18th century, it was developed in London and it was called porter because it was popular with the river and street porters working in London at the time. And it was the first...
It's very sugary.
Very sugary.
Very sugary.
And it was the first style of beer that was brewed all over the world. So beer was very sort of idiosyncratic, really, up until that point.
It was popular with the same sort of people who like three sugars in their tea. Let's put it that way. Yes. They needed the energy.
Exactly.
They needed the energy.
Isn't it, stout? I mean, do you like Guinness? You're an Irishman. You have to say
I love Guinness, I love Guinness and I love Murphy's as well.
So stout is a type of porter because you used to get extra porter, double porter and stout porter.
Oh, a stout is a stout. Well, I wouldn't say stout is a porter.
Guinness extra stout was originally called Guinness Extra Superior Porter. Porter and stout really came into their own in World War One because of the grain shortage. Restrictions in Britain were very strict about how much grain could be used for brewing, but they didn't have those restrictions in Ireland, so they were able to brew more Guinness. Ah. Yeah, and that's when it really took off over here.
Yes.
And the beer we were brewing in World War One was much weaker than it had been. So pre-World War One, the average beer was around 7%, 6-7% ABV.
Wow.
After World War One, your average ale was sort of 3-4%. And to this day, really, you know, you've got your session ales are around,
yes,
or under 4%, really. And they very rarely get over 7% in the pub.
So when I was a teenage drinker, it was like, oh, this is really delicious. It's really strong. And inside I was going, gosh, this is horrible. Well, yeah. It's so strong. And it's like, it's only when you sort of grow up a bit and you go, actually, 4% is nice. You know, that's about what you want.
I'm a strong session ale drinker. I love session ale because I can drink three of them without falling over. It's scientifically proven that women of a certain age, our alcohol tolerance really drops when you go through as you approach the menopause. Yeah. So, and I've noticed it in the last year for me. So I'm in the sort of perimenopause bit, but I just cannot hold my drink. Like even 2-3 years ago. It's really horrible. I hope that stage passes soon.
Jackie, my wife, is not a great drinker. And when we first started going out, we'd go to the pub and she'd go, oh, I can drive. And then another time we go to the pub, oh, I can drive. And I thought, this is the woman for me.
You see, we have to do the taking in turns that we both want to drink. We never want to drive. We have to do the... No, I did it last time. You drove last time.
So where have we got up to historically, Angela?
So then we've got India Pale Ale. It's quite, IPAs are obviously all the rage at the moment. They were really part of the craft beer revolution. And it's only really been in the last, 20 years in America, there was a sort of resurgence of the IPA.
Yes.
And craft brewers making it. But the IPA's got an interesting history. It was... pale ales were very popular in Britain. And when we started colonising all over the place, when the East India Company was formed, the traders would be travelling from Britain en route to India and they wanted an ale to drink.
Yes.
But the ale they had, because it wasn't overly hopped, didn't travel very well. So they developed this India Pale Ale, or IPA, which was an extra hot to preserve it for the journey, which happened to make it stronger as well. That started to become popular with the traders in India, and then it started to become popular here in the sort of mid-19th century. And now it's taken on a whole
new craft beer thing.
But before you know, sort of craft beer wankers of today, of which I am proud to be a bit of a craft beer wanker, you had your proper beer wankers, where you, God love them, and I do love them.
I do love them. We are talking about Camera.
About Camera, the campaign for Real Ale. We should explain what Real Ale is John.
This is very much my childhood. So my dad was a beer drinker and my brother was a beer drinker. And whilst I was growing up, there was this thing happening to British pubs where the cask ale that we sort of take for granted now, the hand pumps, where you get a nice pint of lovely bitter, that was disappearing in pubs. And keg beer had been developed for sort of sale in sports clubs where there was not much turnover. And it was sort of like the difference between UHT milk and fresh milk.
The baseline difference is, isn't it, that kegged beer, it's like basically it's just having a big can of beer. Whereas beer, part of the fermentation process takes place in the cask that it's then poured from.
And it's much, much nicer.
But you have to, a publican has to be able to look after a cask beer because the process is still ongoing.
Absolutely.
Whereas a keg, it's ready to go. Yeah. So you don't need to be skilled in the same way.
Yeah. So my uncle was a publican and he was, under pressure from his brewery to have keg beers in there. They took out the skill from the publican and you just turned on a tap basically. But we would be driving to go to the pub. When we were on holiday, we would drive past a dozen pubs before we would stop because my dad would say, oh no, that's a bloody Watney's house. We're not going in there. Because all these breweries were taking on this keg beer and you couldn't get a decent pint of beer in the early 70s. And Camera was formed, the campaign for Real Ale. And it's one of the most successful campaign stories, you know, in modern history, really, because they suddenly realized that everyone was feeling like, sod this beer's horrible. I love a nice pint of beer. Why are you ruining it by turning it into this fizzy, recarbonated pop? And there was a commercial demand for decent beer, which sort of turned it round in the sort of late
70s. Do you know where it was formed, Camera? It was in Ireland,
in
Kruger's Bar in Kerry on the 16th of March 1971. It was called the Campaign for Revitalisation of Ale, it was called to begin with.
Yeah, it's not as catchy, is it?
But like you say, it was a successful campaign, Camera. I think there's a place for both. Sometimes I want a slightly fizzy keg beer. Sometimes...
I don't mind a lager sometimes on a hot day.
I'm not a massive lager fan. But sometimes I want my ale to be a bit fizzier and, I'm quite happy to go for a keg. Yeah, but some days, a Sunday afternoon in a pub with a roaring fire, I want a hand-pulled cask ale.
Lovely.
That's what I want. I want one now, John, if I'm honest. But that's... Well, so I think that the whole success of Camera and everything, it's it sort of cements us. We're a beer-loving nation. So Elizabeth I, she loved her beer. She liked it strong. She'd drink a quart for breakfast, John. That's 2 pints of beer for breakfast.
It's 2 pints.
The health benefits of beer have been promoted throughout. In the 17th century, the Puritans, who famously don't like fun at all, they took beer with them on the Mayflower. So, because it wasn't really seen as being a vice, beer. It was sinful. It was a healthy drink. St. Bartholomew's Hospital in the East End of London, their records show that sick children in St. Bartholomew's averaged about 3 pints of beer a day.
That's what I say. It's in our genes now.
And that was pre-World War I beer. That was the strong stuff. That was 7% beer. Children were drinking 3 pints a day.
There was an act that came in 1908 saying you were not allowed to sell beer to children under 5.
That's amazing.
Or give beer to children under 5. I like they've said, over 5. You're 6. Fine, it's your round
now,
rate.
A threat did come to beer for a short period in our history from gin. During the time of the Industrial Revolution, people suddenly were moving to cities and working in factories. And factories at that time were hell on earth. They weren't, full of people in high-vis vests with health clipboards, making sure everyone was all right. They were hell. So, understandably, people wanted to escape through gin. You'd do a 14-hour shift at the mill or at the factory.
Yeah.
And gin turned up into this nightmare.
Fastest way out of Manchester.
Yes, quite. And I mean, there's a whole episode to be had on gin, and maybe we'll do that one day. But this is beer. So let's just say the cheap gin craze, for the first time in history, beer was under threat. And rich people at the time, the upper classes, they didn't really bother themselves with what was going on in the slums until they realised the gin epidemic was destroying their servants. And then they realised they needed to get beer back in focus.
And the army. They needed army, that's it.
Like we said before, if your cannon fodder's a little bit pissed, it's fine. But you don't want them so legless they can't do anything.
Yeah.
So they needed to promote beer again. And one of the ways they brought beer back was through its press, and its health benefits. And don't drink gin. People know Hogarth's famous drawing Gin Lane. Well, there's a sort of twin picture called Beer Lane, or Beer Street, it was called. It was a companion piece.
Yes.
Which was a sort of romantic image of happy people. And the only person who looks upset in Beer Street is the pawnbroker.
Good. See, he's right. Hogarth,
so
he's got it right.
So beer was back. And by the end of the 18th century, Prince Regent himself, he proclaimed that beer and beef have made us what we are. Which I think is prone to chronic heart disease. But that's...
Okay, apart from that, very good.
And the custom of Saint Monday was born in the Industrial Revolution, where people would add an unofficial extra day to the weekend to recover. And they called it Saint Monday's Day.
There were always punishments for drinking too much beer in public and being drunk. In James I's time, they put you in the stocks for 6 hours if you were publicly drunk, because they reckon 6 hours was how long it took you to sober up again. And so, it's 6 p.m, the pubs are open again, let's go back in. There was a thing called the Drunkard's Cloak, which was, if you were drunk in public, you had to put on the Drunkard's Cloak, which was a barrel with armholes and leg holes cut out, and you had to parade around in this and shamefully be exposed as a drunkard. So it looks like something from a cartoon.
It was such a British thing, drinking beer. And like we said, safer than drinking water. It was still the case up until the early 20th century. American revolutionary old Benjamin Franklin, he spent some time in London. He worked in a printing house. And because he was American, he would drink water. And people thought it was so extraordinary that they gave him the nickname Water American, because they were very witty. Maybe if they weren't so hammered, they would have come up with a better nickname.
But if you think about, there's a pub in Soho called the John Snow, and that's named after John Snow, the doctor.
Not the newsreader.
Not the newsreader. But he had noticed that the water pump there in Soho was connected to the cholera outbreak. And that's because if you drank water from a pump, you were quite likely to get infected with lethal disease. That's why everyone was getting all the liquids from beer. It was the largest single household expense in the 18th century was the money you spent on beer. Not rent, not food, but beer.
There was a temperance movement growing around this time, which really grew right up into the beginning of the 20th century. Again, we could do a whole podcast, and probably will one day, on the temperance movement, because it's quite... But people genuinely thought that temperance was dangerous, some people, because if you didn't have your beer, you'd get... Yeah. And there was a lovely story of a guy signing the temperance pledge, which we would say, and his friend was saying to him, "Thee mustn't, Richard, thee'll die," which I think is lovely. And there was a story of a Quaker, who Quakers obviously didn't drink, and he applied for life insurance, this Quaker, and he was told that as an abstainer, he'd have to pay an extra premium on his life insurance because he didn't drink beer.
We've got a big statue to the temperance in Clapham here. And as you come out of the common tube and go to the common, there's a great big sort of green lady, and all the winos sit around underneath it drinking special beer and white lightning. It's like this gathering place for drunks, the temperance statue.
The Industrial Revolution obviously had a big effect on the production of beer. Three inventions really allowed it to be industrialised. The steam engine, the hydrometer, which measures the density of liquids, and the thermometer. That meant that beer could now be produced on an industrial scale. And that's when you start getting your big breweries, your Guinness, your Bass, your Youngers, etc.
Do you know who invented the glass-sealed thermometer, Angela?
Mr. Fahrenheit. Of course.
That little other thing you said, yes. The hydrometer. I had one of those when I'd measure my beer. It measures the specific gravity. So it looks like a vertical thermometer. But what it does is measures how dense your liquid is. So you put it in at the beginning of your brew and then mark it down and then measure it at the end of the brew. And you can see how much sugar, how the density.
So it tells you how much sugar's turned to alcohol and how strong it is.
Yeah. And you can, and that's how the customs and excise measure the alcohol content of beer. And I've used to have one of those little things, but I don't know what happened to it. Of course, as soon as I had any money, I started buying beer because it's nice.
Yeah, you are. As your brother will attest.
Yeah, as my brother would point out. Yeah.
Now, beer, you know, healthy drink, we know that, John, but it was still dangerous.
Yeah.
In different ways. In 1814, was the London beer flood. Have you heard about this? Had you heard about it?
It sounds like Homer dancing around in the streets.
I mean, it's an incredible story. This is now, the name of this brewery, is it Mer? Would you say that? Mo and Co. Meux, anyway.
And Co's
Horseshoe Brewery in London on the 17th of October, 1814. A 22-foot tall wooden vat of fermenting porter burst, and somewhere between 128,000 and 323,000 imperial gallons of beer is released. And it destroys the back wall of the brewery and swept into an area of slum dwellings, which was the St. Giles Rookery.
Wow.
Eight people were killed by this tidal wave of beer.
Of beer.
And one of the stories I read about it, which did make me laugh a little bit, was that these two guys in the brewery, they were in like a shed, one of the outbuildings at the brewery. And in the story I read, it said the tidal wave was so strong that it knocked half the clothes off one of these two men. And I was like, did it, or were those two men in the out? But do you know what I mean? I was like, did...
yes, what happened?
Yeah, it was,
was
the beer came and it knocked my trousers off, sir.
I have to say, this title, this exploding beer, this is Britain's Chernobyl, isn't it? The Russians had a nuclear fallout. We had exploding beer. And that's our... They should do a series about that.
I mean, you know, tragedy plus time equals comedy. We shouldn't laugh because eight people did die. Yeah. But a beer tsunami sounds incredible. Did you know, John, that beer was the first thing to be trademarked in this country? In 1875, we had the Trademarks Registration Act was passed. And up to this point, so you had your big brewers, one of which was Bass, which people all have heard of.
Yes, Bass.
They had a problem with forgeries, like people claiming to be Bass beer when it wasn't, and sometimes it was poisonous.
Yes.
There was an incident in Salford in 1900 where 70 people died in a mysterious epidemic, and it was traced back to a fake batch of beer, which was contaminated with sulfuric acid. So it's a real problem for brewers. So Bass came up with the idea of they stamped their barrels with a red triangle, but it turned out quite easy to copy that. So the night the Trademarks Registration Act came into force, a representative from Bass, they spent the night before it sleeping on the steps of the new trademark office to make sure they could get straight in there. And Bass became Britain's first trademark. And
The red triangle.
And the practice of burning them onto the wooden beer barrels is where the term brand comes from, as in a brand name. Because it was
branded into a beer barrel. Today.
There you go. Fantastic. By the end of the 19th century, there were a few large companies accounted for 90% of total British beer output. So it went from being this thing that everyone did at home, the women that did at home, to being this massive industrial scale production that it is today.
Yes. And now we have supermarkets dominating sales of beer, the pubs struggling. We're not going to talk too much about pubs because we might do another episode on that one day. But I'm still someone, I'm considered an eccentric in my local, because I always go down and get my beer in a jug from the pub. Aww. So I walk down there with an empty jug, and everyone else is looking on whilst they know behind the bar, oh, there's John. He always has 2 pints a bit of an evening. And I've done that since I was a student because I so prefer pub beer to canned beer. And apparently my dad and my grandfather did it as well. So it must be a family thing.
In lockdown, lots more people are doing that. I know in the first lockdown, we got a lot of beer from local pubs. And I know in Newfoundland, where I can't go a podcast without mentioning Newfoundland, but local brewed beer is a massive thing in Newfoundland. And they call them growlers. I don't know if that's a Newfoundland thing.
You sell those. So you take your growlers to the brewery
and fill them up for your party. Yeah.
During lockdown, I've got this pub delivering cask ale. He cycles round, this pub in Stockwell, the Priory Arms, he cycles round and delivers me 4 pints Brilliant. For a weekend.
So do find out, especially, I mean, as we're recording this, we're in a lockdown, and when we put it out, we probably still will be. So find out what your local pub's doing, because they've got all this beer and they don't, you know, it'll end up down the drain if you don't buy it.
Yeah, support your local pubs. Enjoy real beer as opposed to, you know, keg pubs. Beer. And,
absolutely.
And the crappy stuff they try to foist on us. Angela, you've taken me on a journey through the story of my favourite drink. I can't imagine what I'm going to do now. It's lunchtime.
I wonder.
I'll go down and have a nice big glass of water. Definitely. I will say, talking about commercial pressures, this isn't really anything to do with this, but I went to the petrol station and I filled up my car and then I got a bottle of water. And I thought, look, I just did a quick calculation and the bottled water cost more per litre than the petrol going into the car.
Mad.
I thought, that's insane. How is that worked out? And how is it that beer in pubs is so expensive and beer in supermarkets is so cheap and that we're prepared to pay £2 for a bottle of water, but we won't pay, you know, the decent price for a pint of beer in a pub?
Much nicer.
So support your pubs. Thank you, Angela, for taking me on that journey. I'm looking forward to Bride Ale.
Oh yes, there'll be a Bride Ale at my wedding. I feel sorry for Spike has got to edit this podcast because we both love beer so much that we have yacked on for ages.
We've been very loquacious, but Spike has plenty of experience working in pubs and breweries himself, so I'm sure he'll do it.
He's
over
used
an
to
evening
quietening down
beer.
The beer bores. That's
exactly, that's us. This is like being back at the pub and two people going, oh, is this real ale, mate? I mean, you did have this image of the beardy boar going on about real ale. But thanks to them, they sort of saved British beer. So I'll raise a glass to Camera and the Good Beer Guide and the pubs that still make an effort to keep proper beer. That's it for We Are History. We'll be back to more traditional subjects next week.
We shall. See you next time. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at We Are History Pod. Pop on to iTunes, give us a nice review. That would be nice. Thank you very much. And we'll see you next time.